Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky. It is Monday morning, Andy, the 16th? How are we doing?
It's the 16th of October.
16th of October, a mere 3 or 4 days, depending on how good you are at counting, before the Lakers begin their season. Is it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? So 4 full days, 3.5, depending on when you're listening. Lakers open up against
all
the Clippers.
These people listening, Brian, have calendars.
They do, but they might not have them in front of them right now.
Well,
it's like when people tweet us, like, hey, how many free throws has Ingram shot tonight? Dude, you are on the internet right now to ask me that question. I am not going to answer that for you.
My favorite response to that is always Bomani Jones will just retweet back the link to Google.
Right.
Every single time.
No. There are certain things where I'm happy to give you the
right fish.
Sometimes you're going to have to teach a man to fish.
Exactly.
All right, so the Lakers open Thursday night, play Thursday and Friday, against the Suns. So we're at the parts where the games count, Andy, and so we're going to talk about that. We'll talk about the starting lineup. The Lakers still haven't quite solidified, at least publicly, who's going to start at the four, which is the big issue, and some injury complications potentially getting in the way of that. We'll give our season preview for how many games we think these Lakers are going to win, take you around the Western Conference, and talk about the only team in the Eastern Conference that's even kind of mildly interesting because the rest of it is a foregone conclusion. So let's start with Ingram. Brandon Ingram has had a mixed preseason.
I'd say somewhere between mixed to underwhelming.
And underwhelming. The last couple games have been a little better, but still nothing.
I mean,
that
I would like to think the last game would have been better because he was playing against the Clippers summer league team.
Basically.
Yeah.
He does very well in summer league.
Yes, he does.
We've noticed.
Yeah, it's similar to the way Lonzo is apparently the greatest scrimmage player in NBA history. Brandon Ingram destroys summer league players.
So we have this setup where Ingram hasn't been great. And part of the reason that we're so hyper-focused on him, A, Lonzo hasn't been on the floor, which we'll talk about. But also, too, Ingram had that nice end of last season. And most importantly, I think, at least for the purposes of this, they spent the summer elevating Ingram. By they, I mean Rob Pelinka to some degree, and certainly Magic Johnson, who announced that Brandon Ingram was untouchable, that he said he was, you know, he's a guy they think he expects him to come out and score 20 points a night and all this.
He's going to be disappointed if Ingram doesn't lead the team in scoring, in part because Ingram's put in so much work, but
right.
Also to
and
it
this,
seems
I believe he, that those comments, I believe, were before they got Lopez. I think.
I don't remember, but I think for these purposes, I don't even know if it matters.
It doesn't matter, but you know, but it does change the context slightly because once you get Lopez, you do kind of expect him to lead the team. But either way, it is, like you say, the potential he's putting in the work and all that other stuff. So,
and also, it would appear that Magic would really like to see Brandon Ingram lead the team in scoring.
Yes, it does. So we put this to Luke before the game against the Sword of Clippers, and I thought his response to this question about Magic and the expectations, and particularly about scoring, was really instructive about how he thinks of Ingram and how the rest of us probably should.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, those aren't my expectations. I mean, I just want Brandon. I think Brandon is so valuable because of the way he can play his all-around game. He can pass, he can guard multiple positions, he can score for us. So I think he's most dangerous when he's just out there playing basketball. So if he scores 20 a night, I love it. But I don't think he should be focused going into the game on trying to score 20, just doing your job. And because he's talented enough, if he's focused on doing his job, he'll have good nights most nights.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
So he's not a scorer. Don't look at him as a guy who's going to come in and drop 20 for you a night, because that's really not, A, not who he is, and B, that's not really, you're not getting your maximum value out of Ingram if all you're focused on is scoring.
Yeah, you know, people, ever since Ingram came into the league, the comp that people have been throwing out with him is Kevin Durant. And because we often do these comps based on what's, you know, what's physically obvious.
Often?
Yeah, often. And by often, I mean always.
All the time.
You know, physically obvious, whether you're talking about, in the case of, Dirk Nowitzki and pick a shooter, they're both white.
Right. You literally cannot compare a European player to anybody who isn't another European player.
Right.
Genetically, we can't do it.
If it's a white player, you know it's going to be compared. You know the guy's going to be compared to another white player. And in the case of Ingram and Durant, a lot of this has to do with the fact that they are both tall, long, and skinny, which, again, throws out the obvious comp. And something I've thrown around a lot myself since Ingram's rookie year, I think if you look at the actual skill set, he's always reminded me, at least potentially, of a rich man's Andre Iguodala.
Yes.
And,
yeah,
you know,
that's a good comp.
A guy that can fill up a stat line. I think the defensive effectiveness is going to come because I think Ingram's a hard worker and he's smart and his body's going to start filling out and that length can be so disruptive. But I even started looking at some of Iguodala's rookie stats and they're actually pretty similar. You know, what Iguodala did as a rookie versus what Ingram did. And you look at some of the per 36s, they're pretty similar. A few of Ingram's are actually better. You know, Iguodala was a better player as a rookie. But he also arrived more developed physically
older.
As a player. He was 21 as a rookie. You know, and he also played on a better team. You know, he played with Allen Iverson and Chris Webber on a team that was good enough to go to the playoffs. I mean, and that stuff matters when you're talking about development.
Sure. But you can't compare Iggy and Ingram, though, because Iggy's like muscular
and
stout.
And like
but, I mean, but
3 inches
shorter. But it's not a bad comparison because, you know, I'm looking at some of Iggy's best seasons. You know, 2007-2008. He averaged 19.9. I'll give him the 20. 20 points a game, five and a half rebounds, five assists, over two steals a game, and a half a block. And so and it's like what Walton is getting at is he's a guy who fills a stat sheet. He can give you 20. He might on some nights give you 25, but that's not if you try to turn him into a scorer. And make scoring the thing that defines whether or not he's being successful, then you're limiting all the other stuff, and you're not going to see everything else that he's doing. His last two games have been, you know, he didn't shoot the ball well in the second to last preseason game, but he finished with like 12, 5, and 6 or something, whatever it was. Like, that is a good Brandon Ingram's stat line. The line he had against the Clippers was a solid Brandon Ingram stat line where you see some of everything. You hope over the course of his career that those numbers go up a little bit, and so you end up with something like 18 a game with 7 or 8 rebounds and 5 assists and a steal. But whether you want to go rich man's Iggy or, you know, super poor man's LeBron or, you know, any of those guys that are
more assertive Lamar Odom.
Lamar Odom, you know, Paul Millsap fills up a stat line like that. Al Horford fills up a stat line like that.
Those are good players.
They're not good players. They're great players.
Right. Those
they're
are all,
excellent
those
players.
Are all-star or all-star caliber players. They're right. Really, really good players.
Draymond without the defensive. I agree with you. Brandon Ingram could get better. Draymond is next level,
right?
And showed up that way, but you can't. The Durant comparison is so bad because it's just so obviously, when you watch how they play and how they arrived in the league, so obviously bad.
Right.
Because Durant, while inefficient as a rookie, came in and was a scorer.
And he also too, he was
see it.
But he also too, and this is where I think the comparison to Durant really hurts Ingram. He was a shooter. From the moment he arrived in the league, Kevin Durant was a shooter in the way that, you know, Brandon Ingram needs to be a better shooter, but I don't know if he's ever going to be the shooter that Durant is. I mean, you know, forget that Durant's going to end up one of the best shooters of all time.
His first season, he was under 30. But Durant's second season in the league, he was over 40% from
30. Right. I mean, and you could see it with Durant. Like, Durant's stroke looked pretty. Like, you could see that he was going to be a great shooter. And with Ingram, maybe it will come around, but I think when you start specifically comparing him to Durant that way, you're doing Ingram a disservice, and you're doing your own expectations of him a disservice.
I just think Durant is a has been arrived as and will always be a better pure scorer than
he's a better player. Kevin Durant's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Right. There are a lot of guys who show up in the league and like they're scorers. Dennis Smith is a scorer. Like,
yes.
You can just watch him play in the preseason. Okay, well, what's that guy's main function? He passes nicely. He's a good player. But like, whoa, that guy can put it in the bucket. You know, Jordan Clarkson, God bless him. I mean, that's all he can do.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. Like, that's his game. But he's pretty good at it, but that's what he does. You know, they thought Ingram would be a shooter when he got in the league. It's part of the reason they liked him. But he's just, there are certain guys you look at it and that whole thing comes, you know, they walk into the league and you can see that's what they do. And I just, you know, to his credit, Ingram has internalized all of this stuff, and it's, I think, part of the reason he hasn't played well. You hear a guy at 20 years old saying, you know, that he needs to remember to have fun and that the coaching staff and the management is needing to remind him to have fun. It's sad, and it kind of makes you a little depressed, but it does show you how much he cares and how hard he's working.
No, he's a
real... I'd rather have that than the alternative.
Well, I mean, it's also, too, like the way Ingram has been talked about has changed a lot. You know, his first year, they said, we know he's got a bright future. We believe a lot in his potential, but we're going to be taking this slowly. We know that this is a development process. You know, less than a year after that, he's being talked about as a franchise cornerstone.
Untouchable.
Untouchable.
In a summer where, look, and I was talking to Trudell about this before the game the other night, and he was saying about, like, you know, what team has ever traded a number two pick that showed the kind of potential that he did down the stretch? And it goes through a whole list. I was like, well.
I was going to say the Lakers.
The Lakers. But the Lakers two seasons ago.
And but still, I'm just some saying.
But setting that aside for just a moment. Setting that aside
the
for
team
just a
that
moment.
Pays right. you, Trudell? Right.
Setting, this is just, we're just chatting.
I know, but I'm just saying, you kind of walked into that.
Aside from the aqueducts, what have the Romans ever done for us? But, you know, I was like, okay, fine. I get that. Teams don't typically trade a kid like Ingram, you know, right off the bat for, you know, unless something amazing is coming back because, you know, if they're looking good, whatever. But in a summer where, you know, D'Angelo was shipped out, and everyone, theoretically, once they got that number two pick, was on the block. And, you know, are they going to trade the pick? Are they going to keep the pick? And all this other stuff. So even if internally you think, man, somebody would have to offer us, like, Westbrook to make that move, or Paul George, or whatever it might be. Just, you know, and even if that's what you're thinking, you don't say it. By saying it out loud, you change the conversation and the context around your player completely. And that's what they did to Ingram. And the downside, and we've talked about it, we talked about it on air, we talked about it here, the downside to all the narrative building that they're doing and changing the perception of the league and all that is they have put an enormous amount onto Lonzo and to Ingram. I don't think Lonzo cares about any of this. I think he will, you know, skate and just sort of move through all of the noise. But some players hear it differently. And I think Ingram has internalized that a little bit more, and they got to figure out a way to get him through it. And I think once they do, he'll be fine. But it's not going to come. He's not going to be an all-star this year. He's not going to be an all-star next year, probably. I'd be surprised. I mean, I did a bet with one of the producers at a Spectrum on Ingram's scoring average this year, over under 13.5. I took the under. Which side of that would you have taken?
I think I'd take the over. But just barely. I think we're looking at about 14.
And the reason I took the under is because I think he's going to have more of those nights where he goes for 17, 18, 19. But every time, he's also going to have three or four sevens mixed
sure.
in there.
And oh,
every,
absolutely.
It just drags down.
Like I said, I take the over, but I take right. barely.
The consistency it requires at the end to average 20 points a game, 19, 18 points a game in the NBA is remarkable. And people don't stop to think about that.
I agree.
So I took the under on that. And I think it'll be close, but I think that's where we'll be. The Lakers still have to finish their starting lineup. They haven't figured out who that's going to be. At the four, really, is the last of the positions. Larry Nance, Kyle Kuzma is in there. And then, obviously, Julius Randle. I said at the beginning of the preseason when they started Nance that I thought that would be a temporary thing, and once Lopez got back, they'd switch that. They haven't done it yet.
No, they have not.
I'm of the mind at this point that the starting lineup that we saw against the Clippers the other night is going to be the starting lineup on Thursday, even if Randall is healthy. Let's assume that he is. He's got the back rib muscle thing.
Doesn't seem to be anything serious.
Right. I hope not. He's on my fantasy team.
Plus, best wishes. Best before,
but also,
Julius.
I have Jordan Clarkson on my fantasy team. I don't feel good about that either. Do you think I'm wrong? I think we would have seen it if they wanted to try it the other way.
Yeah, I mean, unless they're going to really, really scrimmage hard in practice and take a look at it, and I got to be honest, I'm disappointed that they haven't really taken a look at it during a game with Randall alongside Brook Lopez, because I want to see what that looks like in an actual game. The two of them didn't really play together much during the preseason. They didn't get much.
They can still play together. But
I understand they still
it won't be as many minutes.
Right. It's harder to make that happen. It's more difficult to make that happen when you don't take the floor together, to begin with. And I think Lopez's presence can do a lot to open up Julius Randle's game. I mean, he's the type of big that really Randle's never played with before, and I think would be well suited, can space the floor. So I'm disappointed that Walton hasn't done that during an actual game, and I can see some merits to playing Randall off the bench. They could use another ball mover. He's going to have
off the floor when Lonzo's not in, and when he plays with Lonzo, will be great finishing out on the break.
Absolutely. I mean, I can see some merits, and I talked a little bit with Julius about it. And while of course he wants to start because everybody other than Robert Horry wants to start.
Also in a contract year.
Randall.
Well, both. I mean, I don't know how they do it over there, Spectrum. But I don't mean that as a criticism. Sure. I mean, Randall wants to get paid.
I
would want to get paid too.
Look, we talked about this before. I think one of the reasons Jordan Clarkson was so willing to play that bench role last year was he got paid.
Mm-hmm.
He got paid before he was told you're going to be a sixth man. And that makes a difference. Talking with Randall about it, though, it's more important to him that he says, and I actually believe him, that he finishes games than starts. Because all these guys really
I think
care
that's
about
become,
that.
Isn't that becoming kind of the thing that,
yes.
that players are sort of understanding?
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, I'm not sure he's going to do that either.
I know.
And I will say, I am like you. I wish I could have seen it together and what it looks like. But that said, Randall had a pretty good preseason.
Yes, he did.
At least just in terms of the numbers he put up. The other night before he left with the injury, I think it's something like 15 points and 8 rebounds in 12 minutes. So he's been active, and I think he's doing what they want him to do. And so if he gets 28, 29, 30 minutes, and I don't think anybody on this team is going to play more than 33 or 34 a night.
I
think he'll be okay.
You and I have always said that the whole question of starting, it's more of a media talking point. It creates hot talk and whatnot.
It's a player ego thing.
It's a player ego thing. But, I mean, floor combinations and who finishes games ultimately matter more.
Yeah,
just the floor combination part of it to me matters because, again, I think Lopez could help Randall. I think they could be effective together.
We'll see how it goes. But I would at this point be surprised, injury notwithstanding, again, assuming health of that, if they don't leave Larry in the starting lineup. And Kuzma... I wouldn't stick him in there yet.
I wouldn't either.
I am excited that the Lakers seem to have found a guy who is going to be a productive NBA player at the 27th pick. That's hard to do, and they did it, and that's good. Kuzmania, it's better to let it build, and 10, 15 games into the season, if he's just demanding 30 minutes a night, all the better. I don't think we're quite there yet. But that's kind of it. The Lakers, it's going to be a little raggedy at the beginning. KCP won't be in the starting lineup for two games. He's got that suspension, which I think everybody has completely forgotten about. Randall hopefully will be available on Thursday. Lonzo, they expect to be able to practice this week, which is going to make a massive difference. At least they can practice the way they want to play before getting out on the floor, because they haven't been able to do much of anything. And this kind of gets into our season predictions for the Lakers, how many games we think they're going to win. I think Lonzo not being able to participate in the preseason costs them two or three wins during the season.
Good.
Just because everything is centered around him.
Everything's new.
Everything's new.
There's not much continuity from last year's roster.
If you believe everyone, you can't simulate practicing with Lonzo when Lonzo's not there, because it's that different. And I don't think players, coaches, everyone is lying.
No.
And so if he's not there,
I think Caruso probably does a decent job as a watered down version of
Lonzo. He's a scout team Lonzo.
Right, but it's not the same
thing. It's not the same thing. And so I think this costs them a couple games. So that's, if the Vegas over under is 34.5, and I was already at the under, I think it's still there. I'm probably inching a little closer to 30 now than I was right up at that number.
Well, the other thing that's going to cost them some games, quite frankly, is this team still can't shoot.
No.
I mean, Kuzma, all of Kuzma mania that's hit Laker, Laker fans and media, and he's really been good. It's overshadowed the fact that he has not shot well at all.
24% from three.
Right. And,
overall, he's over 50% from the floor.
Right.
But
I'm talking from distance from three, because, right. He shot the lights out in summer league, and my reaction
In the preseason was hitting him again.
Early. And, my reaction was, that's awesome. I want to see him do this against actual NBA defenders. And, I don't know if either sample size necessarily, what either one means, but right now he's not shooting well. And other than, Lopez, and I guess if he's a part of the team, Caruso, nobody's really shooting well from three at all.
Luol Deng, 50%. Luol.
Talk about your small sample size theater. It's going to be problematic for what they want to do.
I think it was Memphis in the last few seasons has been really well known for not making a lot of threes, but they also were also well known for not taking a lot of threes.
They're centered around playing a game where the goal is to put up 80 points a night.
Right. And so, 90. Slow down. Although that's going to be a little different this year for them. The Lakers are going to take a lot of threes.
Yes.
Like a lot. They're going to be bombing from there a lot, and I don't mind it, but we should all understand that they're not going to be good at it.
Yeah. They shot horribly.
I'll go through the percentages. Lopez hit 40% of his threes, almost 42%.
Yeah, taking a few a night.
And to few a night. And I think he'll be somewhere between 35 and 40. He was at 35 last year. And okay, good. KCP, 25%. Brent, I skipped Brewers, 33, because he's not going to play enough. Ingram, 25%. Lonzo in two games, 25%. Kuzma, 24%. Clarkson, 23%. Hart, 22%. Ennis, who was supposed to be good at it, 20%, and Randall, 20. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I
think it will be better in the regular season, but not good enough. Not good enough.
They're going to have a bunch of guys who shoot between 28 and 32%.
Right, which, again, not good enough.
But particularly for the amount that they're going to take. So it really does emphasize how important it is to get Lonzo on the floor. So, A, those threes are clean. They're in transition. They're uncontested and whatever. And that they get easy points that finish at the basket, because they're not going to hit three. They're going to have a lot of nights where they go 6 of 34 from three-point land.
Exactly.
6 of 34.
With that in mind, I'm actually going to take the under two. I'm gonna call my shot at 32 wins. I'm going to take 32.
I wrote that down on the paper before you spoke it.
No wonder we share a Twitter account.
Yeah. And for all of you people out there who say that we each should get our own, I think all of you should find a friend to share your Twitter account with.
What do you care? what the hell do you care? It's obvious. Look, it's obvious why we share a Twitter account. It's a branding thing because we've branded ourselves as a partnership, you effing morons.
Andy would cry if I had more Twitter followers.
That wouldn't happen. But
we'll see.
No, it would not. Okay, we're getting our own Twitter. But that's
I know how to find bots and you don't.
Is it really? That's probably true. Is it
really? I will absolutely 100% fill my thing with followers with bots.
News.
Whatever. If it means having more than you.
Yeah, you will.
I would absolutely and you wouldn't be able to figure it out.
No, I'm not above it. I just can't do it.
Right. So
I don't know how to do that.
All right. So 32. I think. And by the way, that can be a good 32.
Yes.
My concern is that they're going to get off to a bad start, and that'll kind of suck some of the air out of the balloon. But if Lonzo comes back and plays well, and Ingram is having a good season by the end of the year, hopefully, they'll be in good shape going into the summertime. You want to look at the rest of the conference?
Yeah.
Okay. This is tricky. Trying to pick eight teams is not so tricky, I think, because I think there are still eight teams that are probably the clear playoff teams in the West, at least to me. Putting them in order, though, is really hard.
It is hard.
Do you want to start at the bottom or do you want to start at the top?
Oh, doesn't matter.
I mean, we know which. Okay, we'll start at the bottom is sort of more interesting, but the top is kind of intriguing too, except for the one.
Right.
Golden State.
Yes.
Okay, good. You want to do your 8th seed?
My 8th seed, I've got the Clippers.
So do I.
Whoa.
Mind meld.
I've got the Clippers.
I agree.
7, I think the Clippers. Yeah, it's hard to figure out what the Clippers are going to be. And
if
also,
everybody plays and they're healthy, they got more depth. They've got too many good players to be terrible.
I just don't picture everyone staying on the court.
And they're kind of already a little banged up, like Gallo punching people, and Blake is coming off injury, and Beverly's got a knee thing, and like just the odds of this group playing 70 games together fully intact.
Right.
Seems
there are some people who think
really
that, like,
long
that Milos literally is not conditioned well enough to play 82 games.
Well, he's like he arrived off the plane like smoking and all this other stuff. I think they could if everybody's healthy, they could win 47, 48 games.
I agree.
I just think they'll be closer to around 43 or 40.
My 7, I got Portland.
Stop!
Whoa.
Get out of my head, man!
I got Portland.
Yeah, they were an excellent team after the Nurkic trade last year. And they will get in this year.
Full season of Nurkic, I think, will make a big difference. They're going to have to account for what's-his-name scoring. They moved him to the Nets.
Alan Crabb?
Yeah, Crabb in the shooting. But they'll figure it out.
They've got plenty of dudes there.
Number 6, the Timberwolves.
Interesting.
I got the Timberwolves at 6.
I have Denver. But I was really close to putting the Denver at 5.
See, I got Denver as 9. I got Denver missing.
You have
the
them
playoffs.
Out.
Yeah, I'm. This is how much I'm calling my shot. We're gonna have a repeat of last year where Portland and Denver have the exact same record, but Portland has a better head to head.
Now I'm worried. I'm actually like literally forgetting a team.
But yeah, I've got Denver barely missing.
See, I have Denver.
Who'd you forget? Houston.
Utah.
Yeah,
Utah's still a playoff team.
Yes.
Hold on one moment.
Okay, real quick. I'll vamp.
Slide them right where I think they're going to go. You know what, though? All right. I regret to inform the Clippers they're no longer making the playoffs.
All right.
Portland is now my 8th seed.
Okay.
The Jazz of Utah, who are much more nondescript without Gordon Hayward, but are still a good team.
And they're going to be a mother to score.
Yeah, I mean, every night it's just going to be like, this sucks. I do not want to play this team. And that will get you 47 wins in the NBA.
I've got them as my
7 seed.
I've got them as my 5.
Okay.
I actually think they're going to be that hard to score against. And I also think Rodney Hood is going to announce himself this year.
With a Thor attack.
Rodney Hood can put it up. I think Minnesota is going to be good, but it's going to take a little while to figure it all out. And they've got some spacing issues.
I mean, the Nuggets are going to win a lot of games, 147 to 142, which, first of all, makes them amazing
fun
to watch. That offense last year was the best in basketball once they made that, in the second half of the season, once they made that move with Nurkic, they got rid of Nurkic. they stopped trying to play Nurkic and Jokic together, who I called Nokic. And Gary Harris got healthy and came back, and he's really good.
Yeah.
And so
Millsap,
a perfect under the radar thing that's going to make Jokic a better player. Jokic is already awesome, except he can't defend. Jamal Murray is great. It's going to take, they're not going to play defense, but if they are even average, if they can get themselves to average, and sometimes if you're really good offensively, the track meet thing just gets teams to take bad shots and whatever.
Particularly in that building.
Yeah, because you just feel like you have to keep up and your shot selection goes down. So I have Denver as a 6 seed, keeping in mind that my predictions are a little fuzzy now because I forgot a team.
Right. So my 5 was Utah. Your 5
was Minnesota. I do think it's going to take a little while.
My 4 is San Antonio.
I agree.
Kawhi actually, I think, might win MVP this year.
When he gets on the floor.
When he gets on the floor.
This is not good.
I know. Assuming he can play, 75 games this year, I think he could end up winning MVP.
He's good.
That good.
And also, LaMarcus seems into the idea of being a Spur again, which is helpful.
But I also think, Pop is not going to pace them, I think, to win as many games this year.
No.
And depending on Leonard's availability, he may not have a
chance. And they are, of the 4 teams that are clearly better than the other teams in the West, they're the best of the worst of that group, I think, pretty clearly.
My number three is Houston.
Okay. I have OKC.
Yeah. Got my number two is OKC.
And the reason I have OKC at three and not two, and I think the difference between those two teams could be one win.
Sure.
Is just because new thing going on factor is bigger with Oklahoma City than it is with Houston, where I think Harden is just going to be that much better with CP taking some of the ball handling and scoring pressure away from. I actually think that'll make Harden more efficient and more dominant than he was last year, which is saying something. Whereas the Thunder, Russ has got to pull back a little bit. They've got to figure out how they're going to get Melo in there. They've got a couple other moving pieces from the offseason before the Melo trade. I do think integrating George with Westbrook wouldn't have been that hard, but now you add the Melo thing and it gets a little more complicated. And I think they'll also pace Russ a little more because they won't have to run him as hard as they did last year. So I think they're maybe a game or two worse than Houston, but pretty tight.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, everything you're saying makes sense. I think, though, that they're going to offset some of the issues they're going to have with a thin bench beyond Fat Ray Felton and Patrick Patterson and, I guess, Jeremy Grant at times by the ability to stagger Russ, stagger Parker, stagger Melo, which also, though, I think is going to alleviate some of the chemistry issues because you're gonna have opportunities to let all three guys run the action, you know, without the other two. And I think to some degree that's going to help some.
They're really good. It's going to be a really good team.
And also, too, the three of them, I think, are very motivated to make this work. And, you know, look, we've seen before groups motivated to make it all work and it falls to bleep. You know, you know, 2013 Lakers, for example. You know, all those guys talked about how motivated they were to make it work and make sacrifices until they actually had to make it work and make sacrifices. But I have a feeling this is going to work. I really do. Russ has put all ambiguity to bed by signing that extension.
I absolutely think it can work, and not only do I think it can work, I think they have a puncher's chance, as does Houston, against Golden State. I mean, not much.
No.
But at least, you know, something. One
problem is they're a puncher against a better puncher.
Right. One weird injury or something. You know, Steph isn't healthy or KD's not healthy. Whatever it is.
Well, that's why you do them back. That's why you do this. That's why you do the stockpiling. It's not because you think you can be better than Golden State at full strength. Nobody's better than them at full strength. But you put yourself in the opportunity to capitalize if something happens.
Right. And when you're as good as Houston and Oklahoma City and San Antonio and everything, you're too good to tear it backwards and kind of wait it out. You can't do it. And so you have to just say, all right, well, this is the world we live in. Let's try to make it work. The Warriors are scarily enough better than they were last year.
Yeah.
When you start adding a year of KD being completely comfortable in that, and they, you know, Steph and those guys all understanding how that works, and then guys like Caspi and Nick Young and whatever coming off the bench, they're deeper this year than they were last year.
Plus, you're reuniting Team Cinnamon with Nick Young and JaVale McGee. Team
awesome.
Cinnamon.
Now that I have the Clippers out of the playoffs, I think we know my answer to this. But a team that didn't make the playoffs last year, one of the dregs down here between New Orleans, Dallas, the Kings, the Lakers, the Suns, Memphis, I guess, is in it. And of those teams, if you had to pick one that might surprise?
Well, the Pelicans are just going to be a surprise. Like, no matter what they end up doing.
Because they should be the answer to this question, right? Look, they have two of the best front court players in the NBA and an excellent point guard. Hi, Mike Trudell.
How come I never get invited on this podcast?
Because you're on air when we started.
You have a show. Sounds you're like fair. Doing your show.
How you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
Just want to say hi.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for coming.
We're almost done with the basketball portion. Otherwise, we would
invite you to stay.
But we're almost done with the round ball. We'll have you on the next time. Will you come on the next time?
Yeah.
It's a formal invite.
Have some free time.
Okay.
We
cool.
may never record another one again, though. Just so you're aware.
That was Mike Trudell.
Like, they should be the answer to this because Drew Holiday has made an all-star team. That's a big three that's, like, legit.
When I say they are the surprise team, I mean, like, literally, I have no idea what's going to happen. Like, I don't know if this can work stylistically. I don't know if they can stay healthy enough to that even if it works stylistically, it'll matter. I don't know if by the trade deadline, Boogie's going to get unloaded to a contender, and you're going to see like Boston move Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown for Anthony Davis. Like, anything could happen with this team. I could picture them being a 5 seed. Like, anything
could
happen. It's
possible. I mean, like, just because you start with the basic starting point of they've got two of, you know, the 10 best players in the NBA.
15.
I mean, AD is in the top 10.
Yeah.
And Boogie's no worse than 15. I mean, if Boogie weren't crazy.
And he's in great shape right now.
Yeah, Boogie's but I mean, apparently. If he wasn't, yeah. Like, if you take away the off-court stuff and the volatility, talent-wise, he's a top 10 guy.
Well, it's on-court, not off. Like, off-court, Boogie doesn't do anything wrong. It's really all off-court.
But I mean off-court, like locker room, right. Attitude, things like that.
But I mean, if they can figure it out, the two of them, how to play effectively with each other.
Damn.
Holy crap.
Or find, like, a shooter.
Right.
During the season. Like, one guy. Find a guy who can shoot
the
ball.
I mean, there are not a lot of teams equipped to stop the Pelicans if those two can figure out really how to play well. I mean.
But they look at the Lakers going, man, I admire their shooters. Like, there's nobody there.
I know.
All right, so that's that. And the Eastern Conference is stupid to talk about because Cleveland's better than everybody.
The decent teams.
Right, it's Cleveland, Boston. The Wizards are your top three teams that are good. Raptors and the Bucks will
matter.
Be fun and they'll matter. And then somebody else is going to make the playoffs, but who cares because they're not going to do anything. That brings us to the Philadelphia 76ers, who won 28 games last year and in this conference have a very good chance, I think, of getting into the playoffs. Like, it could happen.
It could happen.
Like, Ben Simmons looked good in the preseason. Joel Embiid played like 2 games. And in one of them, scored 22 points in 15 minutes, shot 18 free throws.
It's interesting
in
with
15 minutes.
It's interesting with Embiid because obviously, as he goes, so goes the Sixers. But
they were a good team last year when he played.
We've seen though how effective he can be in limited minutes. Like, I was wondering yesterday, like when I was thinking about this show today, maybe the strategy with him should just be play him 18 to 20 minutes tops. With the strategy of getting like 60-ish games out of him. And if you get 60-ish games out of that type of production, that might be enough to get you in the playoffs.
If
I mean, assuming everyone
around,
else stays
Right, but you
off.
Look around the rest of the roster, and Simmons looks like a player. Saric was great over
yes,
the second
was.
Half of the
yes,
season last year. Embiid is dominant. Robert Covington's a
solid
one of those
players.
He plays in Philly. He wasn't a high pick. But he's a really good player.
Yeah.
I think JJ Redick is going to be massive for them. Spacing the floor is going to, you know, do one thing for them, shoot threes, and that's it.
And he's a smart
He's not a bad player. Defender.
He's not a bad defender. And he also, too, he's hard to cut. You know, he tires guys that have to defend him around. He's gonna find open looks in a way that makes it easier for Fultz or Simmons to find him. You know, I think he's also a guy that will be good for a young team to have around.
I agree.
You know, a guy like Amir Johnson, they brought in a lot of ways. Just be a good guy in a locker room.
But there's no reason, if Embiid plays 65 games, there's no reason that this team can't win. I mean, they could win 28 again. I'm not saying, but like in that conference, they can win 41 games.
28 might get you 60.
Right. But in that conference, they can win 41 games.
No, I agree.
41 games in the playoffs last year.
Yeah, I really wonder if playing Embiid 20 minutes a night might be enough to
actually
make
I don't
happen.
Think he's going to play more than 25.
No.
25 or 30. I mean, just because he can be so good in that stretch.
I wouldn't push 30.
No. I mean, they probably won't, but.
I'm wondering if it's necessary.
Has there ever been a guy that more people hope stay healthy? I mean, I say this a lot about Clayton Kershaw in L.A. Dodgers fans want Kershaw so badly to be good in the postseason because, there's nothing not to like about Kershaw. He's a total team guy. He's a franchise pitcher who is, works out incessantly. He builds homes in, Africa. He does all this stuff. He's a great guy, and you want him to get past this thing so he can, kind of claim his space in baseball history. I think Embiid, on sort of a national level, is becoming that guy that even if you don't like the Sixers, you just want him to stay healthy because he is so obviously amazing at basketball and really fun.
Yeah.
He gets it. He understands the social media age. He takes basketball seriously, but not himself too seriously. I will cry if he doesn't if like something happens to him where he's out for another season or
horrible.
Something.
It'd be horrible. It would be like for me probably the most heartbreaking thing to watch, other than, you know, Odin's the obvious comp, but I would say Brandon Roy. Like what happened with Brandon Roy was heartbreaking to watch.
Where you just knew it wasn't gonna be the same.
Because
he couldn't come
A,
back,
he's
couldn't
so
fulfill
talented,
the promise.
But B, another just good guy.
Yep.
I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find anybody say anything bad about Brandon Roy. I know the interactions I had with him seemed like a really solid dude.
Yeah. They loved him.
It would
there.
Just be awful.
All right, so you have him in?
Yeah.
I think they get in.
What the hell?
I think they get in.
Yeah,
I mean, they have 41, 42 wins.
Let's
I think
do it.
They can
let's
do
put
it.
Them in.
But I mean, it's
which,
the
by the way,
only if, interesting thing about the bottom of that conference.
If they get in, I mean, maybe even if they don't, but especially if they do, that makes them a very interesting player next offseason.
Well, this is
agency.
But this is why I wanted to talk about them as in conjunction, because they are the sort of the Eastern Conference version of the Lakers, and Philly doesn't have the cachet of LA as a free agent destination. I think we can all agree about that. But if they look like they're going to be a lot better, and you already have Embiid there, and you already have Fultz, and you have the pieces to move all these things to go get another star, if that's what you want,
and a bad city to live in,
it's not awful,
and it's not a small town.
No, I mean it's grumpy
fans,
grumpy. They're angry there, but you know they have the Liberty Bell.
No,
it's nice,
Rocky
good bell,
statue,
good bell,
sandwiches. You got some strong sandwiches, man.
If they're good and the Lakers struggle a little bit, that can change the math,
people,
I think, to some degree. Maybe not on LeBron. LeBron's not going to Philly.
If people have gone to Cleveland to play because they were good, people will go to Philadelphia to play if they're good.
If they're good and, you know, can get that other – I'll go play next to Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, and they can trade Fultz, and they've got all these other draft
absolutely
picks, and they've got all this other stuff to come along. I mean – they are, I think, a legit. I mean, they're also, I think, unless the numbers have changed, and I didn't realize it, one of the only other teams that has the ability to create significant cap room next year.
Yeah,
and so they are the Eastern version of what the Lakers are trying to do.
Be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Real quick, before we get out of here, last week was the 20th anniversary
of Boogie Nights.
Of Boogie Nights.
It was, I believe, a week ago yesterday.
Last week was a busy week, so
yes. Either a week ago yesterday or a week ago tomorrow, one or the other. But it was basically a week ago. And it's a movie you and I both just love.
It's a great movie. And
it's probably 10 to top 15.
Where do you think, that was my first question, because like you're better at remembering all this stuff offhand than I am, but like where do you think Boogie Nights lands like 20 years later in sort of like on the important film scale? Like whether pop culturally or like among film geeks in terms of how movies are made and
I think it's still pretty massive. I mean, it's a movie that I think it's enjoyed longevity. I think, you know, it's held up well in the eyes of people who liked it. It also too, I mean,
it does hold up very well.
It holds up really well. It announced Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, he made this movie, I'm guessing, when he was about 25 years old. That is a staggering achievement. For a filmmaker with, he had one movie, Hard Eight, under his
Boogie
belt.
Boogie Nights was
97. It was 97.
He was born in 1970.
Yeah, so
he's making it in 96.
Yeah, he's about 26.
With one movie.
Right. And, I mean, forget.
One like, really good movie. Hard Eight's a really good
it
movie.
It is a really good movie. But, I mean, like, forget how the quality of Boogie Nights, you know, and, like, the way it's shot. You know, I mean, like, it's a really ballsy movie.
Those sequences, there's a lot of that. Like, we make a huge deal out of the scene in Goodfellas where they walk in the back of the club.
Yeah, Copacabana.
Right, and there's a lot of that.
Oh, there's two or three
in Boogie Nights where, and what's
the opening scene?
Yes.
At their version of the club, which is basically their version of Copacabana. There's the pool party scene, which is a lot of it's unbroken.
And what's amazing about that is, and what's amazing about Boogie Nights is, like, you start to go through it and like. Everybody's in that movie.
Yeah.
Like everybody. Like I wanted to try to pull up the clip of of Wahlberg at the very beginning when he's telling the girlfriend that he's dating, you know, that he's gonna be a big, bright shining star, which obviously becomes a theme throughout the whole thing. But like that girl is the one of the girls from the L world. From the L word and is everybody is in it. And you know, and with real good defined
the
roles.
The humanity that Paul Thomas Anderson brings to these characters in this very skeezy world that's very easy to take shots at, you know, and obviously,
and they take a few.
They do. I mean, he pokes fun at the world, and you know, at times these guys are not particularly bright, and you know, there's a very big fish in a very, you know, small, very particular pond factor that Anderson makes fun of, but he's never condescending towards these characters.
No, and I think like there are certain things
he clearly has affection. He actually created the Dirk Diggler character when he was like a teenager. Like, he made a short out of
it. Yeah, and I went back and I watched some of it last night just because I knew we would be talking about it. And, like, one of the scenes that strikes me as so timely is the one where, who's the actor who comes in to talk to the colonel? And it's
Philip Baker Hall?
Philip Baker, right. He comes in and is trying to explain to Burt Reynolds that film is dying and video is the future, which any red-blooded American male knows turned out to be true.
Yes.
But it's that thing of, you know, and they do poke fun at Burt Reynolds feeling like he's an auteur and he's making films and he's so proud of himself. You know, he's like, we made a movie. Like, we made a real film here with the, you know, the Brock Landers features. but like that sentiment.
It's not great. It's
of,
excellent.
Look,
it's
we work in that world.
Yes.
Of, you know, we were there like kind of raising our hands, you know, at the LA Times going, guys, this internet thing is, it's not temporary.
Yeah.
And, you know, worked with the cliched people want the feeling of the paper in their hands and the ink. And no, they don't.
No.
And you guys better understand that.
You
quickly.
And I tried to save media.
We did.
We did our best and we got
failed.
Ignored.
We failed. But like scenes like that. That, you know, yes, you're making fun of porn films, and it just seems so weird. The idea of going to a porn theater seems so weird.
It's
now.
Very strange that ever became a thing.
Like, that's one of the things. We talk about a lot about the death of, like, communal experiences. Like, everybody's just wrapped up in their phones. And this is one place where it's probably better for everyone. We can all just do this in the privacy of our own home, and we don't have to go to a theater.
That really, really was never meant to be a group setting.
This is an improvement.
Yeah.
You know, we all should look up from our phones every once in a while and look people in the eye, not while we're doing that.
the scene to me that's always stuck out with me the most in Boogie Nights is the Coke sale scene with Alfred Molina
with the kid throwing firecrackers in the back.
To me, what's amazing about it's, you know, it's an awesome scene. I think for a lot of people, it's the scene they remember the most. But to me, what's always struck me as so amazing about it, you know, beyond like the Night Ranger and the Jesse's Girl and, you know, like Cosmo, he's Chinese. You know,
that's what they do.
Throwing the firecrackers around.
Alfred Molina, just the silk robe.
The Russian roulette. Yeah. Like, what's amazing about it, and I don't know if I've ever seen this before in a movie, is the more tense that scene grows, like where you can see like, oh my, this is spinning somewhere bad. Like, bad things are going to come from this, the funnier it gets.
Yeah.
Like, it actually becomes so absurdly tense and so absurdly dangerous that it becomes funnier. And that's hard to do.
It is hard to do. You're right.
I also was looking up a little bit about Boogie Nights, Brian.
But also, too, but real quick on that, has anybody named Todd ever done anything productive in anything? Like, shouldn't they have known that scene was going to go downhill? Because they invited a guy named Todd to the thing.
Yeah.
Todd's help nothing.
No. I wanted to bring up real quick some casting choices I learned about through IMDb or Wikipedia. The original choice, or a guy who was offered it at least, for Dirk Diggler was Leonardo DiCaprio. And he loved the script. He turned it down because he had a conflict with Titanic.
You know what?
And he actually recommended Mark Wahlberg.
I was about to say, Wahlberg has... DiCaprio is too polished. And was too polished, I think, at that point of his career as an actor. Whereas Wahlberg, I think, still Wahlberg could play dumb, so to speak. I think dumb and endearing in a way that I don't know if DiCaprio would have pulled off. I think he would have been sitting there going, that's Leonardo DiCaprio too much. Not Leo's fault. But
plus, also, there was this joy of seeing this out-of-left-field choice with Mark Wahlberg crush the role. You know, and actually turned into a really good actor. Mark Wahlberg's actually a really good actor.
He is.
Nobody would have seen that coming.
But at the time.
No. I mean, he had done like Fear and Basketball Diaries.
I was about to say, I'm looking it back up. And like, it's not that it was his first role.
No,
but it's not.
He'd never done anything like that. He'd never been a lead.
But there was something. He was just so Like the optimism and the innocence of him playing that character.
You know, like you said, kind of dumb, which worked with Wahlberg's persona. I mean,
he's
at
doing
the
karate stuff, yeah, and he's like this, that, and whatever. And you know, but he wanted so badly. I mean, all these people just want so badly to be noticed,
yeah,
in some way, you know. And you know, William H. Macy wants to be noticed, if nothing else, just wants to be noticed by his wife,
yes,
who will stop bleeping people all the time. And
yes,
by the way, wonderful casting choice to have Nina Hartley,
yes,
play that role.
Yes, real life porn star.
Actual porn actress.
I got all these.
You know, I mean, there may not be a sadder character in the movie than Don Cheadle.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say Little Bill's pretty.
Little Bill's pretty bad. But like Don Cheadle.
Don Cheadle's
at least
very
is
sad.
Sort of younger.
Yes.
And
he's so trying to find his identity throughout, you know, the entire movie.
That scene where he's selling the stereo to the guy.
So great.
He's got him all. He's got him roped all the way in, and then he puts in the country western.
Oh, it's so
and
great.
And he's like bopping. He's like, move. You can do it. You know, let it out. Like, I know you want. And the guy's just like, I got to go.
He's casually drinking the coffee while he's right, swiveling his hip.
But it was such a good sales pitch right up until the point where he uses his hook. I'm the cowboy guy.
Right.
And it fails.
And then real quick, Jack Horner, Burt Reynolds' roles. Here's some of the people that were offered it and turned it down. Jack Nicholson.
No.
I don't like it either.
No.
I like Jack, but I don't like him for that role.
No, it's because he would have been too much. You know what he would have done? He would have done The Departed.
I don't think he would have done
version, the, he would have done
a
version
done the
of a porn version of The Departed.
I don't know if he would have done that because I don't think the script would have allowed it to him. I don't think Paul Thomas Anderson would have allowed it.
Yeah, he's a little...
But I just think it would have been too much persona. Harvey Keitel, who I just think has the wrong voice. It's a weird thing
he does,
to say.
But I think he could have done it. I think Keitel would have been good. Burt Reynolds and Keitel are in that same where there's something about the arcs of Burt Reynolds, particularly the arc of his career, that really makes it work for that role.
There's an art imitating life factor,
right, which I think
Reynolds
people picked up on. And
certainly
he did.
Oh,
when you read the interviews and stuff like that.
He did, even though he, I mean, famously hated the role, hated the movie, fired his agent after it. He hated Paul Thomas Anderson. Anderson offered him a role in Magnolia, and he turned it down. He's like, I worked with him once. That's great. He was apparently a pain in the ass, Burt Reynolds, on the set. But, you know, it's easy to forget. Reynolds, when he wants to be, can be a really
good actor.
And he's so good in this role. Here's one choice, though, that I do think would have been, of all the, Bill Murray got offered it.
That would have been interesting.
Would have been interesting. I still think Reynolds would be better, but it would have been interesting.
It helps that Reynolds is better looking.
Yes. Well, and also, too, I mean, he's an icon of that period.
Right.
He's an icon of the 70s. I mean,
But I just think, like, you know, porn director, filmmaker,
yes,
whatever, like, good looking, but like in a... slightly dated.
Yeah,
I mean, it
Murray,
aesthetically is.
Yeah,
bad.
Murray's always interesting, but I think Reynolds is better. Albert Brooks, I think, is interesting, but wrong casting.
Yeah,
interesting.
I'm trying to think of them. I can't picture the movie.
But here's the guy that got offered the role that I actually think maybe could have come as close to Reynolds: Sidney Pollack.
That would have been fascinating.
Sidney Pollack
would have been fascinating.
Was a really good actor.
He was. That would have been fascinating.
He's mostly remembered as a director, but he was a really good actor. I mean, he doesn't have quite the right look as Reynolds.
No, he's not skeezy enough.
Right, and the art imitating life factor isn't there, but just from a pure acting.
It's a testament to a movie where you know it's good when you have trouble inserting other people in the role.
Yeah.
Where you just say, no, that doesn't work because the experience is so different that you can't picture it with other people, whereas bad movies, you can plug in anyone. It doesn't matter.
But at any rate, I mean, Reynolds is so great, and the movie is just so
fantastic. You go through it, and there are so many people in this movie.
I know.
And the quality of the actors are so good.
There's so many memorable lines, memorable scenes. It's like, I have not loved Paul Thomas Anderson's last couple movies. I couldn't get into Inherent Vice, and I thought The Master was interesting, but
Scotty. Kind of is up there for sad characters.
Oh, yeah, Scott.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. Oof. That's pretty sad.
doubly now when you think about what unfortunately happened with him. But Boogie Nights ultimately, though, like, made it clear to me when I saw that movie, I will see every single movie Paul Thomas Anderson ever makes. Because you're just like, you watch that and you're like, I want to see what he does.
Yeah.
I will always want to see what he does.
Just so then, very few movies, and just to wrap it up, can put characters in positions where... You know they're not there because it's like, if you know, you have other alternatives, you know, but like, you don't you see very quickly how Roller Girl gets from point A to point B. And that's like, this is for better or for worse, and really for worse, this is a place where she can
Well, the
be
limo,
a person.
We learned. I mean, we ultimately
right.
learned.
You can be somebody.
Yes.
That she, you know, she couldn't be in high school. She sits down, takes that test, and she's like, I can't do this. Anyway, great movie.
It's a fantastic movie.
All right. Lakers start on Thursday.
Yep.
We'll talk about it next week. Bye.